In the spring of 1945, even as the carnage of the Second World War continued, representatives from nearly 50 nations, including the great powers of the world, met in San Francisco to approve the Charter of the United Nations. For more than 2 months, these delegates successfully and perhaps even surprisingly maneuvered around one political obstacle after another. And as our guest this week illustrates, from their diaries, internal memos, and meeting minutes emerges a fascinating history of the drama and diplomatic intrigue behind the formation of the United Nations. Stephen Schlesinger is director of the World Policy Institute at the New School in New York City and author of The New Reformers, Forces for Change in American Politics, and Bitter Fruit, the story of the American coup in Guatemala. His latest book is Act of Creation, The Founding of the United Nations, published in 2003 by Westview Press. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you for having me.
The first thing that grabbed my attention in your book was just how involved Franklin Roosevelt was in the planning of the United Nations. Give us a little background. Why that level of interest?
Well, Franklin Roosevelt had been the Assistant Secretary of Navy in the administration of Woodrow Wilson. And as you know, Wilson had been the proponent of the first international global security organization that the U.S. had ever indicated an interest in, and that was the League of Nations. But the League of Nations, unfortunately for Wilson, went down to defeat at the hands of the American Senate. So Roosevelt, who had himself been a supporter of the League, had learned some bitter lessons from the defeat of that organization back in 1920, and determined that when he became president, that he would try to recreate another organization along the lines of the League, called in this case the United Nations, which could actually be one that the Senate would approve and that would live up to the ideals of a collective kind of security organization that all states could join in as a way to prevent the outbreak of war in the future. As early as 1939, he understood that the World War was coming. He realized European states were in conflict, so he secretly instructed the State Department to start working on a UN charter, because he felt very strongly that if a world war did come, when it ended and when, as he hoped, the U.S. would be victorious, there had to be some security organization that would prevent any further outbreaks of war in the future. And this is why he instructed his State Department to work on this charter so that by the time the war ended, it could be brought before all the other countries of the world as a way of binding together these states around a common set of principles that would preclude the emergence of any new conflict in the future.
Well, given that sort of depth of commitment that FDR held to the UN, that seems to set up a kind of a paradox. Because in America, the United Nations seems to be often a target of criticism. Is it fair to say then that few people realize then how much of an American project the United Nations really was?
Actually, one of the reasons I wrote this book was to remind Americans that it was really our government and our president, that two presidents actually, first of all Roosevelt and then Harry Truman, that created this organization. Without their involvement, there would not really be, in my view, any UN today. So the American role was absolutely essential. You have to understand that in 1945, the U.S. was the most powerful country on the planet, even more powerful than it is today. We did not have to create an international security organization. We could very much have done what is in currency today, the notion of creating coalitions of the willing. And that is something in 1945, as the most powerful country on the planet, we would have readily been able to assemble these coalitions for any action we wanted to take overseas. But it was Roosevelt's belief, followed by Harry Truman, that it was far more important to have a permanent organization that would, in a sense, embed the U.S. in a international body that would permanently anchor all nations together in a single organization, and that would help prevent the outbreak of war in the future. And it was much better to do that than to get involved in coalitions that could easily wither away very quickly after a crisis ended.
Well, bringing up Harry Truman is appropriate. I mean, we just talked about how committed FDR was to the project, but he would, of course, die just a few weeks, matter of fact, 13 days, I think, before the conference. One of Harry Truman's first acts as president, as you point out, if not perhaps his first act as president, was to ensure that the conference would still occur. Was that surprising to anyone?
When Roosevelt died 13 days before the conference began, this country, America, was in crisis. Here we had a situation where a new president had come into power. He was not particularly well known. He was a man without a lot of known history in his past, particularly in regards to internationalism. He's a man who had never gone to college. He'd been abroad once in his life, to Europe, when he was fighting in the First World War. So he's a very enigmatic figure. And the question was he willing, 13 days before the international conference was to begin in San Francisco, to set up the UN, to go forward with it? I mean, after all, he had a lot of other sudden responsibilities. He still had to fight a two-front war, one front in Europe and one in Asia, in the Pacific. He had responsibilities for working with a new Congress. He had to work with allies that he'd practically, in many cases, never met. He had a foreign policy team that he inherited from FDR. Many of those people he never had been acquainted with before. So he had enormous responsibilities. And yet, his first decision as president was to go forward with the UN conference. And it illustrated the fact that, in fact, Harry Truman was one of the great internationalist presidents we've ever had of this country. He was a man who was a self-educated individual. He had learned history on his own. He knew the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. He knew about Greek history. He knew about the foreign policy pitfalls and strength of American history. So he had studied very carefully all of these dimensions of history all through the ancient times up to the present, and realized the most important thing you could have in order to create the conditions for peace was to have a collective organization of states working together around the principles of peace. And that's what he very much was committed to when he authorized the UN conference to go forward.
Well, let's turn to that critical conference itself then. Why San Francisco?
The decision to go to San Francisco was a kind of intriguing one. It happened actually at the very famous conference that Roosevelt held in Yalta in February of 1945, with Stalin, who was dictator of the Soviet Union, and Winston Churchill was then head of the British government. And Roosevelt was accompanied there by his Secretary of State, a man named Edward Stettinius. And it was Stettinius who, while at Yalta, had a dream, as he reports in his own diaries, in which it came to him that they should have the conference in San Francisco. Why San Francisco? Because he felt it was on the western frontier of this country. It suggested that much of the new action in the post-war age would be in the Pacific Basin. It also demonstrated the commitment of the U.S. government to fighting the war against Japan, which was still going on. And he went to Roosevelt and said, you know, I had this dream, and I thought for all these reasons we should make sure the conference is situated in this Pacific California city. And Roosevelt thought for a moment and said, yes, let's do it. It's a beautiful city. It has all the attributes we need to demonstrate the strength of why this organization is important.
Well, not only was that decision to hold the conference in San Francisco then a very deliberate one, but American planners seemed willing, if not eager, perhaps even over-eager, to control even the smallest of conference details.
The United States invested $25 million in putting together this conference in San Francisco. And $25 million in 1945 was a lot of money. I mean, you have to remember, we were spending immense amounts of our capital financing this two-front war in Europe and Asia. We were in the process of inventing the atomic bomb, which was to be used a couple months later. We were financing the economic reconstruction of war-torn countries around the globe. To spare $25 million to put on this conference really reflected the determination of the government in Washington of the importance of creating the United Nations. In addition, we put literally hundreds of our military personnel, our civilian employees, all to help mount that conference. We even brought in the Office of Strategic Services, OSS, which was a forerunner of the CIA, to help devise and put together many of the insignia for the United Nations. In fact, the color blue, which we now associate with the UN, was invented by artisans from the OSS. Even the emblem that you now see on all UN flags, which is the flattened globe surrounded by garlands, was also devised by these OSS artisans. We even employed military personnel to make sure that there would be no outbreaks of violence at the convention. We provided buses to transport delegations around. We flew in many of the delegations from war-torn countries that had no means of transportation. We flew them in on our own military planes. It was in a vastly organized conference, and we were absolutely determined to make sure there were no mistakes made, as had happened with the League of Nations.
Well, given that commitment, given that investment, and perhaps playing off your comment about the OSS, leaving nothing to chance and certainly wanting to influence the outcome also meant that espionage or spying was a major element of this conference. Is that correct as well?
One of the big surprises in my research was to find out that the Army Signal Corps, which was the unit that dealt with intercepting cable traffic from around the world, had in fact spied on all the countries coming to San Francisco. If you can imagine it, we knew in advance the negotiating positions of practically every other nation. The reason why is I've talked to various people who knew something about the operation was that Roosevelt was so incredibly concerned that there might be some disruption at the conference that would ruin the chances for the UN Charter, that he felt it was okay to know in advance these negotiating positions from the other 48 countries coming, or 49 countries coming to the city of San Francisco, in order so that the U.S. could, in advance of the conference, prepare all sorts of compromises or changes in positions or a new wording for the charter to accommodate these concerns of other nations. And that really seemed to be the reason why. But I will say, we were not the only people spying out there. The Soviets had their own operatives working in San Francisco. The British clearly had spying personnel. And who knows who else was bringing in their own operatives working on some sort of levels of espionage during the meeting.
Well, given all that, it seems that by almost any measure then, that the eventual ratification of the UN Charter was a monumental achievement. As these original supporters saw it, what was going to be the role, what was going to be the purpose of the United Nations?
The main purpose of the United Nations was to create a security organization. In other words, an organization that would be formed to promote the idea that if there was any conflict in the future around the globe, the UN would intervene militarily or with sanctions or with some other measures to stop that conflict from spinning out of control and creating a Third World War. That was the real reason why everybody, all those delegations, came together in San Francisco. And by the way, it might be said at this point, 60 years after the creation of the UN, there hasn't been a Third World War. All the other affiliated organizations that one associates with the UN, UNESCO, UNICEF, United Nations Development Program, World Health Organization, and so on, were, in the sense, after the fact. They were not part of the main reason for the UN's creation. They became part of the larger mission that the UN had dealing with social issues around the globe. But the real central organizing principle for the UN was the security problem, making sure there was no further conflicts of a worldwide nature.
Well, the ongoing war in Iraq has certainly brought the United Nations back into the public spotlight. But it has also highlighted, I think, to a limited degree, perhaps the limits of its political power, at least from an American perspective. What possible solutions or possible alternatives exist to make the UN a more effective body?
Well, the Iraqi war actually pinpoints both one of the strengths and the weaknesses of the United Nations. You have to remember that when the UN was set up, there was two divisions. There was a General Assembly in which 191 nations all had an equal vote, and then there was a Security Council in which five countries had the veto. There was 15 members on that Security Council. And the Security Council was the more important part of the UN in terms of war and peace issues, because the Security Council made the decisions whether the UN would intervene militarily in actions around the globe. By the way, when the Security Council makes a decision, it is binding on all the 100 out of the 91 nations of the world. So when that council makes a decision, it legitimizes, in the eyes of the rest of the world, a action by the UN. When President Bush came to the UN and asked for its support of an intervention in Iraq and didn't get it because the Security Council determined that they had to have UN inspectors first find out if there were any weapons of mass destruction before it authorized such an action, Bush simply on his own circumvented the Security Council, on a unilateral basis sent in the troops to overthrow the Saddam Hussein and his regime. But in doing so, he lost the legitimacy in the eyes of the world for what he did, and in fact left the U.S. isolated in Iraq. Having faced that isolation and realizing that he needed the support of the rest of the world, Bush then went back to the U.N. and got another resolution supporting the reconstruction process in Iraq and also in elections in Iraq, and therefore suddenly regained legitimacy in the eyes of the rest of the states who were members of the U.N. So that is where the U.N. plays its classic role. It legitimizes actions to prevent conflicts. And if you don't have that, you're in a mess. But if you do have it, you do have the support of the rest of the globe.
Well, thank you, Stephen. That was very illuminating. You've been listening to Stephen Schlesinger, author of Act of Creation, The Founding of the United Nations, published in 2003 by Westview Press. This is Talking History.